last week was a very, very long sermon. Amen? Yeah, that's right. Last week was 55 minutes long, which is 5 minutes longer than today's will be. But there is so much to talk about that really is of importance. The Christophany, its visitation of the pre-incarnate Christ to Samson's parents, and its parallel to his visitation to Gideon. The Nazarite vow, which had been before this, just a moment in time, and Samson is the first person to be called to a lifelong vow. The two-tier conversations, and how it seems as though God is intending to harm or hurt Samson. It's so difficult what Samson is going through from his perspective, being unaware of this two-tier conversation. And most importantly, from my perspective, is that Samson, I believe wholeheartedly, that God intends Samson to be a living, breathing illustration of Israel to Israel. This happens. Remember Hosea? Hosea did not like his calling there. An example of Israel to Israel. Here, this is Samson's life. He is a living, breathing illustration. A teaching moment for them to see how they are. Samson's a mirror held up for the Israelites to understand their own image. Samson is called. Samson is chosen, set apart, consecrated. Samson is born of the miraculous, instructed, commanded, raised up. Samson is blessed by God. That is Israel's story. So is Israel. Samson, though, tolerates and compromises, seeks to use the world around him for his own benefit, his own pleasure, indulges in, embraces the world, the very system that he is supposed to be separated from. That is an image of Israel. So does Israel. Samson is attracted to the Philistine women. And he tells his parents, quite literally, I'm going to do what's right in my own eyes. In my own eyes. That is an illustration of Israel to Israel. This is what they do. We have this parallel conversation, this celestial conversation, this earthly conversation. God is enacting his own will in and through Samson, and Samson is enacting his own will. And they are both heading in the same direction. God is strategizing the opportunity to begin the redemption of the Israelites from the Philistines. The same time that Samson is seeking an opportunity to satisfy himself with the Philistines. And you have to read the story carefully, keeping in mind the Nazarite vow. After tearing apart a lion while at a vineyard and later gathering honey from a honeycomb in the carcass of that dead animal, Samson goes to the bride's house for the wedding, in her town, surrounded by her family and her friends. It is obvious that Samson is being drawn toward the culture of the world around him, and that his bride is not being drawn towards his. His ego at that wedding, if you'll let me remind you, his ego causes him to make a wager with 30 of her townsmen. And she conspires against him for the benefit of her own people. And in anger, he goes out and kills 30 Philistines in order to pay the debt of losing the wager. While he's out, her father gives her as a bride to another guest at the party, another man. So in revenge, Samson burns the crops of the Philistines. So in revenge, the Philistines kill the girl and her father. So in revenge, Samson slaughters a great number of Philistines. And it's at this moment that those two conversations converge. An enmity, anger, hatred, resentment, bitterness, grudge match has been put between Samson and the Philistines. And that's where we're picking up today. Samson's on the run. He retreats to a cave back in Jewish-controlled territory. And the Philistines, who have iron weapons and the Israelites have none, the Philistines surround the area. And the Jewish men, Samson's own people, learn that the Philistines are all around and they are ready to capture Samson. And the Jewish men don't want to be destroyed in the process of the Philistines getting Samson. So 3,000 Jewish men gather and they capture Samson and they bind him with new ropes, possessing not to kill him, but to just hand him over to the Philistines, satisfy the Philistines so the Philistines don't destroy us. As Samson is about to be handed over to the Philistines, we see that the Spirit of the Lord rushes upon Samson, which is a different word than comes in to stir him, trouble him, as we saw before. This time it rushes upon him, and he tears these two ropes as if, it describes, they were charred, burned candle wicks. And he finds a bone, and if you read carefully, it's not a dried up bone of a donkey's jaw. It's a fresh bone of a donkey's jaw. It's fleshed out still. It's wet. What is he doing looking for a dead animal like this? He's a Nazarite. But he takes this bone and he kills 1,000 Philistines. And then he sings. What is, I'm told in Hebrew, a very poetic song, a beautiful song. And he throws down this animal carcass and realizes at that moment that he's exhausted and he's thirsty. And he cries out, acknowledging that this is God's victory, that the victory he's just had is of the Lord. And then he questions why God gives him victory over his enemies simply to let him die of thirst. Does this sound familiar to you? Coming out of Egypt and in the desert time and time and time again, having seen the miraculous, having participated in the miraculous, just to sit down and question why God has brought them there to die. So God miraculously causes water to appear. Samson is revived. There are a few things that I want to point out about that little part of the story. The word bind, used to bind him, it's used 70 times in the Old Testament. Okay, 20%, one-fifth, 20% of the times it's used in the Old Testament, it's used in regards to Samson. It means more than tie up. It means to imprison, to capture, to make something or someone a captive. It's the stated goal of the Philistines to capture or imprison Samson. Second thing here is that we have seen other judges rally armies in Israel, Gideon and so forth, Deborah, Barak. The only time an army is gathered during Samson's leadership. It's not to capture the enemy, it's to capture him. The only time the Jewish men gather around and rally to do something is to capture the judge and hand him over to the Philistines. Number three, again, he's grabbing, he's looking, seeking out. I mean, there has to be other things there. Big branch, big piece of wood, find an ox goad, you know? Shamgar killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. But he keeps seeking out. He's a Nazarite. He's taken a vow. He's been given a vow, a lifelong vow. You don't touch dead animals. What does he find? The most recently dead animal he can find for a weapon. No regard for his vow. And number four, most profoundly, did you hear what the Jewish people said to Samson? Quote, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What have you done to us?" They become so accustomed to the enemy ruling over them that they're not upset with the Philistines. Don't bother them. Don't get them angry. Sounds like the Pharisees. Quiet it down or the Romans will come in. They're upset with Samson for upsetting their enemy, the enemy that's oppressing them. We should pause and think about that. Trying to keep down, keep quiet the enemy. Trying not to upset, becoming angry with people holding us accountable or teaching us difficult things. Becoming angry at the people who stand up to the enemy is often our first inclination. Do you hear Israel's story in Samson's life? Do you see it? The Spirit of God moves. There's a miraculous victory, a feigning of, "We are yours and you are great." And then the complaint. "Why did you give us a victory just to leave us here to die of thirst or whatever?" A miraculous provision of water. And then the spring gets named the spring of the one who cried out. Samson is an illustration of Israel to Israel. He's their mirror. For some reason now, been revived, having wiped out the Philistines now, he starts walking through the streets, not of his hometown or his own people, but he's strolling along through the streets of a Philistine town named Gaza. It was then, it is now. He sees a prostitute. He chooses to spend the night with her. The town people have recognized him and watched him as he strolled through their town. They know he's there, and so they're plotting to kill him, and he knows they're plotting to kill him. So under the cover of darkness, he tears loose the gates of Gaza. These gates are somewhere, from what we understand, between 10 and 20 feet tall, double-planked wood, clad in metal. You have thick beams and stone hinges. And he carries these gates, hinges and beams and metal and all, upon his shoulders. A great distance away into Jewish territory. Culturally, what's going on here is when you have a victory, when you have conquered your enemy, you take the gates of their city off of their hinges, leaving them vulnerable, it's obvious, and you put those gates in your territory where everybody can see you beat them. That's what he's saying. He's making a statement here. There are a few things that I want to point out about this little spot, this little story in Samson's life. why in the world is this chosen, consecrated, set-apart man strolling through the streets of his enemy? How often do we try to find out what is sin and what isn't sin and get as close to it as we possibly can? Walk right up to the line, feeling good that we haven't crossed the line yet. Why is this consecrated, set-apart man indulging his own will? Prostitute, a Philistine. Why is this man who is supposed to be a light in the darkness allowing himself to be hemmed in on all sides, surrounded and ensnared by the darkness? Do you see Israel's story in Samson's life? He's not driving out the Philistines from the land. He's strolling through it, admiring all that it has to allure and entice him. He's attracted to the women of the land. That is what is said of Israel. A prostitute, no less. And he embraces her, and he's ensnared and hemmed in. And again, this miraculous strength from God comes upon him in this moment of peril. And he has a demonstration of victory over his enemies, leaving them vulnerable. Then we're told that he falls in love with a valley girl. Valley girl? Oh, gag me. Valley girl. Some of you don't even know what a valley girl is. This is straight out of the 80s. The Bible doesn't explicitly tell us who Delilah is. There's nothing directly that says she's a Jewish person. There's some debate. Most scholars think she's not Jewish, that she is probably another Philistine prostitute. The evidence that they give is that the men, the rulers of the town, know her, and they seem to know her very well. They don't threaten her life as they did the woman from Timnah who was going to marry him. They offer her money. So they know her really well, and they offer her money. And the money that they offer her, by the way, is $35,000 in today's economy. Okay, it's a lot of money. It doesn't appear that Samson marries her, because it says that he's constantly visiting her, going to her house, and not that she lives in his house. So I sort of agree with most commentaries. She is probably another Philistine prostitute. Five rulers of the five Philistine cities come together, and they offer her this $35,000. She tries to find the secret of his strength without success. She quite literally asks him, how can you be enslaved? This word bind, you know, how can you be bound? What it means is, how can you be captured? How can you be enslaved? And the first time he tells her, with 9 straps of fresh leather or fresh animal sinew, bind me with the body of a dead animal. This is really good for a Nazirite. This is great. Second time he tells her, okay. Not the dead animal sinew. How about just new ropes? 7 new ropes, you know? The third time he tells her, you weave my hair into fabric on the loom and secure it tight. Yeah, like a big old hairdo. That'll take his strength away. All to no avail. And then we're told that after just a ton of nagging, I mean, she is just really getting into him, you know? You got to tell me if you loved me. If you only loved me, you would prove you love me. She presses him, and he can't take her anymore. He says, I'm a Nazirite! Don't you get it? I'm a Nazirite. My strength is in my hair. Shaves his head. And he's captured. And what do? They pluck out his eyes and they put him to work. They literally make him a slave. There are a few things that I want to point out. This is probably the most famous part of the Samson story. Not the Christophany. Not that. Not the Nazirite vow. The first person to take a lifelong Nazirite vow. Not that. Not the example of Israel to Israel. Not that. Not the two-tiered conversation. It's the most famous part of the story is he got a haircut. Got a haircut. Number one, notice that Samson is fully aware, fully cognizant of the Nazirite vow. He knows it. He understands it. I'm a Nazirite. I've been consecrated. I'm a consecrated man since birth, since before birth. He also understands completely because he divulges it. He tells her, cut my hair, and it's all over. He knows. He's not unaware. He's not caught off guard. He's not tricked. He gets it. Number two, regarding the Nazirite vow, while there are instructions of things to abstain from, sacrifices to offer, the sign of a Nazirite is uncut hair. How do you know someone is taking a Nazirite vow for a moment or someone is a Nazirite? They don't cut their hair. Numbers 6:7 literally says, the Nazir, it's the separation of God, is on his head. This is it. The separation by and unto the Lord is the hair. It's not uncommon. It is not uncommon to see a sober Jewish man. If you saw a sober Jewish man, you wouldn't say, what's going on with that? Why is this guy sober? That's not uncommon. It is not uncommon to see a Jewish man abstain from unclean things. When you see a Jewish man abstain from certain things, you go, oh, it's because you're Jewish. You're abstaining. I get it. What is uncommon is to remain unshaven for a very, very long time. There comes a point in time in the course of a week where someone says, Brian, you should shave. I don't like shaving. I really don't. I mean, you take a blade and scrape it across your face. It's not fun. I don't like shaving, okay? There comes a point in time within 3 months that all of a sudden, where is she? Right there. This old lady. She comes up, you know, I love your curls, but they look better if you get them cut. You know, my hair gets down here. When I had long hair in high school, I had longer hair than you. Maybe Abby, I had it somewhere, sort of like Mia here. I had long hair. Man, I took grief. Okay? In their world, to do that, you knew something was up. Imagine Samson has never cut his hair or shaved. And he's a grown man. You understand what's going on here? It's obvious something is up. Oh, he's a Nazirite. Oh, he's taking one of those vows. Oh, this is what's going on. It's an amazing thing what he does here. He's not breaking one of the do's or the don'ts. He's not touching the unclean thing or drinking the wine at the vineyard. He's actually removing the sign. He's removing the sign of the relationship. Notice number three, when he woke up, he said, I will go out as other time and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. What a sorry state of affairs that is. He's caught off guard by his own spiritual condition. And how sad that is. You should be evaluating your spiritual condition all the time. All the time. God never moves. We do. We do. Number four, notice that he is walking around, strolling around, and listen, looking at all the enticements the world has to offer. He saw a Philistine woman in Timnah. He saw a Philistine prostitute in Gaza. He saw and fell in love with Delilah. And as I've taught you so many times over the years, there comes a point in time where God says, okay, I've been trying to get your attention through this, through that, through the other. I've been trying to tell you, Spirit has been prodding your heart. You never are surprised or shocked by your own sin. It doesn't creep up on you. It doesn't catch you off guard. You plan and strategize your sin because you like your sin. And Samson, okay. God says, fine. Have it your way. Have it your way. And what do? They pluck out they don't cut his nose off. There are cultures where they'll cut the ear off. There are cultures where they'll put a big fish hook through the lower part of the jaw to keep you. There are cultures that will put chains around your wrists, around your neck even, your feet. What do? They pluck out. He saw a woman. He saw a prostitute. He saw Delilah. They pluck out his eyes. The sin you allow to remain is the sin that will enslave you. It's the sin that will bind you. Do you hear Israel's story? In Samson's life, he knows his calling. And he knows, he's completely aware of the consequences. But this time he's all in. His heart is gone. He treats this as some sort of game, as some sort of thing he can play at. This is not breaking a rule here or there. This is breaking the relationship. This is breaking the sign of the calling. Nothing's left. And then the Lord departs. And he didn't know it. The Lord left and he was unaware. You know your calling. And you know the consequences. Are you playing at this thing? You know your set apart, sacred, consecrated nature. How close to the line do you want to tread? Why do we stroll around in the world, in the society, in the culture, looking and looking and looking? Some of us know the pain of crossing that line. Indulging our own will. Having it our way. We can tell you it's horrific. Remember those two conversations, the celestial conversation, what God is doing, and the earthly conversation. While Samson may have been aware of the celestial conversation, guess who wasn't? The Philistines. The Philistines were completely aware of the celestial conversation. They understood that this was a battle between their God and his God. Who's stronger? Who's going to win? Who's going to prove himself? And doggone it, they believe that their God has won the day. Where do they have him? Where do we next see him? In a temple. The Philistines want to celebrate Dagon. And so, as most cultures do, they bring in all the implements and instruments, the wonderful gold and silver and all those battle armaments and the captives into the celebration. And Samson's brought in. He's brought into the temple of Dagon. The rulers of all five cities are there. The temple is seriously full. It's hard for us maybe to grasp this, but it has a terrace, a balcony, a top portment on the temple that can hold 3,000 people. They're all watching. We're told Samson performed. We don't know what that means. I don't know, was he doing some sort of strongman act? Was he playing out his victories and then they're conquering him? What was he doing? We don't know. But at some point in time, Samson is utterly exhausted. And he's obviously humiliated. And it seems as though in their temple, in front of all of them, while they celebrate Dagon, he becomes in great distress. He secures a position for himself under the guise of resting. Secures a position for himself with these two main pillars, two main supporting structures there. And he prays to the Lord for just one more moment of strength. One more miraculous time. And he says, quote, to avenge my own two eyes. You work for me. God complies. Two-tier conversation. Samson has his will. God has his. He breaks the pillars and the temple collapses and all the leaders and the people inside the temple, they're all killed. His family retrieves the body and buries him in the family tomb. And he is then known for killing more Philistines in his death than he did in his life. There are a few things that I would like to point out about this scenario, this moment in Samson's life. As we looked at the circumstances in which the Israelites find themselves in the book of Judges, out of the 10 or 11 times that we have seen the Lord deliver them, only one of the 10 or 11 times that God delivered the Israelites in Judges, did they repent? Did he answer their cry for help because they said, we've sinned? We've sinned. Only one time. All the other times, they are crying out for relief, are crying out for revenge. And here you see Samson. You do not see Samson confess his sin. You don't see Samson repent. You don't see Samson fall on his knees and say, what have I done? He cries out for personal revenge. Maybe in a twisted way, sense of deliverance, you know, or relief. But personal revenge is the forefront. And the Lord delivers him. The Lord strikes the enemy. Number two, we've looked at 11 judges prior to Samson. With the other judges, we see the language, the verbiage, sometimes direct quotes. They judged Israel for so many years, or the land had rest for so many years, or there were so many years of peace in the land. But with Samson, it says he judged Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. These were not the days of Othniel. These are not the days of Deborah. These are not the days of Ehud or Shamgar or Gideon even. These were the days of the Philistines. The Philistines were in charge. They ruled the land. There's no mention at all here of rest or peace. Number three, I want to draw your attention to something here. When God the Father took the Israelites to be his beloved, his espoused at Mount Sinai, he instructed them with the do's and the don'ts. Do this, don't do that, don't touch this, offer this as a sacrifice. But what was the sign of their relationship? What was the sign of their relationship? Someone said something. Sabbath. Sabbath was the sign. This shall be a sign between us. You see, when all the other nations saw that Israel stopped when they didn't, when all the other nations saw that Israel communed and had this moment set apart for God and for the relationship, they understood there was something special here. And Israel breaks the do's and the don'ts. Israel touches the unclean and doesn't sacrifice what they should. Israel even commits, as God says, adultery. You've cheated on me. You've cheated on me. But what is it they're condemned for? As Ezekiel tells us, Jeremiah tells us, breaking the Sabbath. Breaking the Sabbath. They're condemned for breaking the sign of their relationship. And they're going to spend a certain number of years in captivity for every year that they didn't have the Sabbath rest. Ezekiel gives us a dramatic and touching depiction of the Spirit of the Lord at that time, leaving the temple and then leaving the city and then leaving the land. And what's so funny is that the Israelites had no idea. They didn't know. They didn't know he was gone. They were unaware that their enemy was coming and bound them and enslaved them. Samson, you see Israel's story in Samson's life. Do's and the don'ts he breaks, and the unclean things and the adultery, even the prostitution, the immorality. But it's when he cuts the sign, when he breaks that sign, that he's put into bondage. As Israel's time goes on, and the sign, the Sabbath rest upon the land is restored, she's released from her captivity. As time goes on and Samson's sign is restored, he is also released from captivity. Let's conclude this morning. Let's conclude our study of Samson with three truths. Three truths that we can all walk away from. If every episode of Samson's life gives us a synopsis of Israel's life, Samson is a living, breathing illustration of Israel to Israel, and their story is
our
story. Samson is a living, breathing example of us to us. Samson uncomfortably and awkwardly holds a mirror for us to look at, to observe, to understand. Number two, please know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the enemy, his enemy, your enemy, the enemy understands, always has, does, and always will understand that this is a battle. Battle of the enemy and the one true God. The enemy always understands that it's the indulgence of the will, the indulgence of the heart that leads to slavery. Your desires, your hopes, your dreams, your wants, your wishes, your timeline, what you envision for you, always leads to captivity. Understand beyond a shadow of a doubt that the enemy is always calling you to compromise just a little bit, to tolerate just a little bit. Yet, the enemy will never compromise with you or tolerate you. The enemy is on a seek and destroy mission. Never compromise with those who want to destroy you. Our battle is not against flesh and blood. You probably heard that verse. It's not against flesh and blood. And you need to recognize that we live in the enemy's system. We are in it, but we are not supposed to be of it. This is his world, his domain. He's in charge. And if you have any doubt, look around or turn on the news. You're surrounded by a world that hates God. And this was a difficult concept for maybe my parents or my grandparents to understand, especially in this country. It was a difficult concept to really grasp when I was a kid. But now, open your eyes, open your ears, look around you and see the hatred for God's word, God's ways, God's precepts, God's teachings. See it. Look stone cold in it. Because this world hates you. And it's constantly trying to entice you to compromise and tolerate it, but it will never tolerate you. And finally, what's most disturbing, most sad? Samson never came to grips with his set apart, consecrated calling. Israel never, still has not, to this day, come to grips with her consecrated and set apart calling. And I'm afraid that the church at large, has not come to grips with its set apart and consecrated, sacred, holy calling. The only question for us to answer is, have you? Have you and I come to grips with it?